from Germany to the San Fernando Valley, from technical photography to plein air painting. Quite a journey. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Krissa Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce this program twice a month here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Our focus is the visual arts. Today we are talking with one of two painters who is going to be part of an exhibit at Studios on the Park in Paso Robles. The show opens this Saturday for Art After Dark. We'll give you those details later. The two painters are Carl Dempwolf and Deladier Almeida. Carl is a native of Germany and Deladier a native of Brazil. We'll talk with him next week. On their way to Paso Robles, Carl and his wife Diane stopped at my house, where we were able to sit and have a delightful conversation about a life that has been filled with things that have truly made him happy. Off to my dining room with a little tea and lots of conversation. Carl Dempwolf, good afternoon.
Hi, Krissa, how are you?
Fine. And Stephen's here too.
Hello.
Carl, you are about to be part of a two-person exhibit up at Studios in the Park in Paso Robles. But we're going to start with how you got here in terms of being an artist. Do you remember early on in your life when it mattered?
It didn't really matter until the last 20 years. Earlier on, I was just doodling like kids do. And my mother would often, after we immigrated, would say, listen, here's a nice postcard of the Zugspitze, which is a high mountain in Germany. And we lived there. And she said, can you do a painting for me and stuff? My birthday's coming up. And this would happen over and over again over years, and that was kind of my early art interest.
Did she keep them all?
We do have a few of them left. We do have a few from 1956 and around that era.
So what happened, you say, about 20 years ago?
Well, I was always interested in art. I mean, always have been. I was more interested in photography. I went to Art Center when Art Center was still downtown Los Angeles on 3rd Street. Took photography classes. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be a photographer. Going to school to be a painter was not really on the agenda. And so I pursued being a photographer and filmmaker for a while. While I was pursuing this, I was also painting. This is when painting started. I would work in the garage. Plein air was not part of my way of painting at that time. It was simply, here's a nice photograph. It's like the photographs I took on the drive up here today with all the nice green grasses. And I would just work, but photography and film was what I wanted to do.
What type of imagery has excited you about photography over the years?
Well, in the beginning, it was just learning the craft. It was more of a, let's do something. And so we made a motorcycle film. Bruce Brown made that early motorcycle film. We loved what was going on. And we had some 16-millimeter cameras. And we went out and followed a number of people who were in a race. And we put that together. And then we rented the Van Nuys High School auditorium to show our film. So film became really part of my weekends and summers. Eventually, we decided, this partner and I, who was teaching the same thing that I was, educationally handicapped kids in the elementary school level. But on weekends and in summers, we were going to make educational films and film strips, and that was going to be our foot in the door for a career in that business.
Wow.
Yes, it's interesting. You said you were born in Germany, so how did you get to the United States?
My father was an engineer during the Second World War and always loved flying. He loved gliders, and he was an engineer. And so he worked in the aircraft industry for a number of aircraft manufacturers. And he, after the war, decided to start a business. And then in 1949, Lockheed came and said, hey, would you, we've heard some good reports from you. Apparently, that was the first vetting was done by the paperclip group that came to America right after the war. And so my dad was asked in 1949, and 54, the clearance came, and that's when we got permission to come.
And what part of California did you settle in?
Well, we settled in Southern California. We've been there the entire time, literally, in Van Nuys, because it was close to Lockheed, which was in Burbank at the time. And then we moved to Sherman Oaks. But really, before we came to California, it's that we got a taste of America at my mother's sister's house in Irvington, New Jersey. And I'm telling you, from walking into a home that had tile on the floor and tile around the wash basin and a white refrigerator, comparing it to what we had in Germany, was like we had died and gone to heaven. It was wonderful.
Here I thought going to Connecticut and having a whole variety of different soda pop wasn't part of my household. That in the donuts that were on the table every morning for breakfast. It is interesting how different worlds open up. You go to somebody else's neck of the woods. The photography was going on, and you're indicating that you're still interested in capturing images.
I think capturing images of when I go out and paint on plein air, or capturing images like when we drove up here. We're kind of under pressure to get to Paso to drop the paintings off at the studio at the park, and no stopping, pulling over, and taking a nice shot, just click, click, click through the window, you know.
I know it well.
Yeah. The green was so brilliant, and most of the places you can't stop anyway, so it's just a memory trip of how California can look after the rain, so it was wonderful, you know.
There's so many different things that as the driver, I can't point and shoot very successfully. So the painting, were you teaching yourself? Did you go back to school for that?
Well, I did go to school at Cal State Northridge, and Hans Burkhardt was the in-house resident artist.
Yes.
And Diane took the class, and I loved the work that she brought home being in his class. I had an art class, don't remember the instructor, and we did things that weren't of any great interest. So my training really came by me working by myself in the garage and starting to look up artists that I really loved looking at. And they were usually the early California group. I mean, all the way back earlier, of course, from Monet and that whole group of Impressionists in France and Paris. But as I discovered later on, Impressionism was literally like a world phenomenon. I mean, it just happened everywhere. And then if you go back even further, even the Anastasi and the Canyon de Chelly were plein air painters by scratching pictographs on the sandstone walls.
How did you get into plein air? I mean, if you start out in your garage.
Yeah, I started out in my garage.
Keep the door open.
Yeah, plein air really happened through the California Art Club and Peter Adams, who is and his wife Elaine, who are single-handedly responsible for regenerating that wonderful art organization. It was founded in 1909 by William Wendt, Edgar Payne, and Benjamin Brown, a bunch of early California artists. But Peter was asked, do you want to regenerate? Do you want to remake this club what it used to be? And he said yes. And that's when I started going out, painting out in nature, probably in the late 70s.
What were you finding particularly appealing about getting out of your garage and doing the plein air?
This plein air stuff and the garage stuff kind of paralleled for a little while. I mean, I was kind of used to this. It felt comfortable. And not that I did any great paintings during that time, but I got used to how to use a medium and the brushes. And so it was just a basic training camp. And so I really started to go out with the club and people. We started coming up here toward Carpinteria. There's a large industrial area just before you get to Carpinteria, which is oil companies own that land, and to bring awareness to it, we go out there and paint, sell our paintings, raise money for an advertising campaign to save those lands for future generations.
Locally, we have a group called Slope.
Yeah.
They have had the wonderful experiences of being able to get access to land and then doing the same thing, working to raise money to help preserve it. You obviously found a niche.
Well, the niche was that I was asked to join. I did. And the club was very active, always putting on exhibits, always going out, raising awareness. And then that's when you started making close friends with people who had the same interest as you. And it just kind of snowballed. And then something happened which was not planned, because I was laid off from my photography career. I was working for an aerospace company in Van Nuys, and called the Marquardt Company. They were into the rocket and ramjet business, and business was good for a long time. And then all of a sudden, mid-90s, it turned terrible, and I was laid off. And who's going to hire a guy who's close to 60, you know? And so at that time, I decided I was going to just paint full time and see what happens.
That big risk.
Yeah, being forced into the art field.
Yeah, well, I really love my job. I love the high-speed motion analysis we were doing of combustion chambers and rocket engines. And this company provided all of the motors, all of the rocket motors for the shuttle, every single one of them, except for the large boosters that would get it off the pad. So we were very busy, and it was fascinating work. Painting was good, but I really liked this. Plus, it was making paying the rent, you know?
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Our guest today is Carl Dempwolf, a plein air painter who is part of a two-person exhibit that opens this weekend at Studios on the Park in Paso Robles. We'll give you information about the exhibit at the end of the program. But now, let's hear more from Carl. Much thought about that duality of worlds of engineer, artist.
I'm not a scientist. I really am not like my father, who was. And I think I must have missed a whole bunch of his genes, because that was never ever a part of my schooling. I mean, you can just tell.
So your role was one of documentation with the company that was making all of the parts?
They wanted to document an object that had failed. They wanted to document something that they had built and were selling to the government. They wanted to document things that happened in slow motion and that you could only see at high rate of speed, like 10,000 frames, to see what happens in a glass combustion chamber. How does that happen? And of course, the whole thing only takes a few seconds. I would facilitate them learning by being able to shoot the stuff in that way.
And that ability to slow things down. Okay, we can't see this with the naked eye, but we know something's happening. So
it was fascinating. I mean, that's why I said I loved it. But it's also the people that I work with, because most of the people in the company were World War II vets. They were pilots, bombardiers, navigators, and every lunch I'd spend time with these old-timers, and we talked about what they knew best, you know, flying their P-38s, sitting in the driver's seat of a B-17, and we're right next to Van Nuys Airport. So every lunch, if there was nothing else going on, I would sit in one of the cooling towers for the ramjet tests that they would do, and I'd watch airplanes take off and land, you know?
It's funny, because my father was a navigator in the U.S. Air Force to begin with, and then he was stationed at Vandenberg when they were doing all the rocket testing. He used to always call us up, because they weren't allowed to make public announcements as to when the rockets were going to be shot off, but he'd just go, "Okay, kids, go outside, get on the roof," because we could see the launch pads from up on the roof.
So that type of technical photography, were you teaching yourself?
Remember, I was. We were making educational films and film strips prior to this job, and so I had gotten a nice background. So I learned a lot of things as we were learning our business in making educational film strips, and so that's where a lot of that technical knowledge came from. Then there was a transition period that was really fascinating, because all of a sudden there was this company, Marquardt, that had an opening, and a person by the name of Spielberg was making the first Star Wars film just down the street from the studio that we had. And the big decision was, and we had just had our first daughter in 78, and the decision was, do I go to a company where you get a paycheck, or do I go to a rogue company that didn't want to do their first film via the union and become a lineup person? It's real simple stuff, lining up film. And one of the partners in this little studio we had went with Spielberg And I went to the company that makes the rockets and ramjets. And my life would have been totally different if I'd decided the other way.
Would you have gotten into plein air painting, do you think, in the way that you have?
No, because I don't think so. I think if you were Spielberg, kept the people on that did good jobs, and you probably wouldn't have gotten laid off, then there would have been less time to learn the business. Learning the business by going out and doing it is what really caused me to be a good photographer and filmmaker. And then getting laid off from that job and having been working with the California Art Club and on my own for years, I ended up kind of slipping into the I'm now a painter kind of a career. Eventually, film and photography became kind of a distant memory. And then it became just brushes and paint and mediums. And today is, where do I get odorless turpentine, you know? The good stuff is only sold out of the state of California. Yeah, my passion for painting and the arts and stuff really developed once I decided this is my new career and this is all I'm going to do and I'm going to devote my life to it. And then it became starting a library and cutting out pictures out of magazines and saying, yeah, this is what I like and what is it that I like about it? The design of it, the color layouts and the harmony of this particular piece. And so that's really how I transitioned between being a working person in a company and having a boss to being my own self-boss by being a person who painted and decided to critique my own work, which I do so vigorously after all these years. It doesn't seem to stop. I'm just the most critical person, and things I'm supposed to be handing over to a gallery or to a show, I mean, I'm working on them 10 minutes before I put it in the car and drop it off. It's terrible.
But that raises an interesting question. Can you talk through a little bit the kinds of challenges or the kind of questions that you put to yourself?
The analysis really hasn't changed much between then and now. Is this piece working for me or isn't it? Is there something in here? Yes, something's bothering me. Something, is it the heavy paint that I've put on, the impasto paint? It's starting to catch its own shadows. Do I start scraping it and removing some of the paint? Are the masses that I've created interesting shapes having nothing to do with what I happened to have seen when I was painting the original sketch? Because now I'm designing it from scratch, because the painting that I did on location was small, 8x10 or smaller. And so there's not a lot of information. So the photographs that I take help. But it's still redesigning what you've seen, looking at your sketch, and now coming up with a painting that works for me. I'm the guy that has to be happy with it. It may not win a prize, it may be purchased, it may not be, but that's really irrelevant. I need to be the person who is self-evaluating what he has done. And it seems to almost be like a long-term disease that never seems to go away. You're always doing that. If you're serious, some people who are weekend painters and whatever they create out in the open, they're fine, they're done, they're finished. I never seem to finish.
I think one of the hardest things to learn as an artist is when to stop.
Yeah.
It's a really difficult thing to learn.
It's very, very difficult. I see things hanging on the wall at home and coming up here. Isn't that strange? I was thinking that on the way up here, seeing that light hit that light green. I've got a painting like that. Highway 46 between Paso and Highway 1 at Cambria. And at one time I had it lighter in areas if the sun were hitting the green grasses, but it's over the time, it's disappeared. And I look at this painting every day. It's very large. And coming up here today, and I saw that sunlight, and I said, you know, I may want to do that to that painting. And that happens all the time from paintings that come back from the gallery, too. I've been thinking about the painting. What changes do I want to make on it? What was it that bothered you that you never resolved before it went to the gallery? And then it comes back, and then I try something, and then I ruin it.
Which is a possibility.
It happens lots of times. It happens.
As a silversmith, ruining something has far more consequences. I mean, the metal is now used for scrap. I definitely can envy people who have that time factor. And yet, as you say, sometimes that time factor becomes its own detriment.
I've worked on some paintings over a number of years. I'm never happy with it. I never feel that it's ready for the gallery or for some exhibit. It's finally, one day, it comes together for whatever reason. You know, it's just one of those strange mental things. I don't know why I didn't see this before.
Do you find that putting the painting away for a while helps?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's why we're in there in the gallery up in Carmel for a while or anywhere else. I'm no longer reacting to it. I'm no longer involved in it. And so when I give it to the gallery, it's gone. I'm not thinking about it too much, but eventually it comes back to me and I have thought about it, and now I think I'm going to try the following.
Are there pieces that haven't made it to the gallery yet?
Oh, there's some that have never made it to the gallery. There are some people that never seem to make it, either because I enjoy looking at them, and I'm still not totally satisfied that this is really the final version. There are some that have been in galleries that have come back to me, and I've got them hanging, and it's a wonderful place to hang them around the house. You're walking by them all the time, you're thinking. I've had thoughts about it, and I've tried to go back into it, and I don't know what else to do. It feels like it still needs something. Does the sky have to be a bluer blue, more cerulean? Are the clouds too wishy-washy, too far in the background? Do they need to come forward? It's frustrating, but it's also something that's what you do. I mean, you do that all the time, and there's almost no way around it, unless you're satisfied, unless you've made a painting that's a copy of what you saw and it exactly what you saw, then you're done. For me, I'm never done because I'm never making a copy. You know, I'm always interpreting, always trying to stretch the envelope, stretch the truth of what I actually saw. Am I adding things that weren't there? Absolutely. And the reason for that is because I want it to be exciting for me. And maybe somebody else will find it exciting as well. Yeah. You know, I do like to find compositions that are already set to go. There they are. But so often that's not the case. And I remember doing a report on Wendt for the California Art Club. They wanted me to give a little report on this early California artist. And one of the things that he was telling a poet who was interviewing him, and he said, you know, those hills in that painting you're looking at really aren't from there. I took them from somewhere else and put them in this painting. So we know that artists, you look at their compositions and it looks so perfect. And it really wasn't perfect because he's the one that ended up borrowing rocks or hillsides or trees and put them where he wanted them. And so that was a great learning experience for me. You know, you try to find the perfect composition, but rarely, rarely is that the case.
Ain't it the truth? It's one of those things that in my paintings, if I get 90% there and I still can't find out the solution, I just put them away. And usually after about 6 or 7 months and I pull it back out, what is wrong with it is glaring to me.
Yeah.
It's not something I'm going to see if I sit there and stare at it.
No, absolutely.
Your style?
It's kind of a California style, you know? The process of sitting out in nature and being overwhelmed with what you see or being influenced by what you see. And sometimes the influence is such that I've got to back away from that influence. Sometimes I feel nature and reality is really overwhelming me and I'm making what I'm trying to paint too real. And I don't want to be too real. I really don't. I want it to be an interpretation. I want it to be me. And I think that's one of the things that stands out in my work. My work is very identifiable. And is it because I move away from reality? Probably. It's probably my brush strokes, and it's probably a number of other things, too. I like going out and sitting in nature and going through the process of sitting down, and I've got a little tiny box, a little paint box my brother made for me. It's a wet box. It holds 5 by 7 inch boards. And then I'll sit out there and go through the process of making a sketch on a little notebook that I've got and where it is. To me, that's the ultimate. I mean, getting that sketch and the photographs into the studio, making enlargement, that's when it becomes work. The rest of the stuff is just pure joy.
And the style itself, one image that I saw, I was not hit with a sense of what I would call photorealism either.
It was, my stuff is never photorealism. It never will be. It can't. I mean, to me, that's a craftsman. I'm a laborer, not a craftsman who want to put every pine needle on a pine tree. I can't do that. It would just drive me crazy. I want the large masses, and I want to create them in such a way that they're pleasing to me. An impressionistic, contemporary impressionistic style with flavors of some of the early California artists. I'm influenced by all those people. And when I get to Arles, and we're on a cruise down the Rhone, and this is where Van Gogh stood and he painted this, and this is where he stood and painted the bridge, the little opening bridge and stuff. And so, of course, I take my paints and go where he painted and try to sit in the same spot. For me, it seems to be a really important thing. It does. For some, it's encouraging to me. I love sitting in the same place with some artist who I admire and paint in the same spot, you know? I mean, it's wonderful. It really is. To me, that's really what it's all about.
You have not mentioned what medium you work in.
Oil is what I've done 99% of the time. I've tried acrylics occasionally to see, will I have a lucky accident? Can I change my style somewhat to explore new areas? And I still have some of those paintings that have never been seen by anyone, but I look at them and I say, well, this is not half bad, but it's a medium that I'm not real familiar with. But I do try to use other mediums like acrylics once in a while just to find out, is there something of interest for me to pursue it?
Is there something that you want to make sure we know?
Well, I should have thought about that before.
Put you on the spot.
Yeah. I think that I mentioned it already, but I think the one time I feel so totally alive and so totally at one with nature and creation is when I'm out plein air painting all by myself, not in the big crowd, and sit there and go through that process of making the sketch. And it's enlightening. It really is. It makes me feel wonderful. And if I didn't emphasize that earlier, but it's really something that I find so totally and completely the opposite of working in the studio, where I'm trying to reintroduce that feeling that I had at the time when I was outside into this enlargement, into this new painting from small sketches that I've done out in the field. And that's when it becomes real labor. I mean, real labor. But sitting out in nature and going through the process is what makes me feel whole. It really does. It makes me feel like I'm in an unbelievable career that other people, they won't know what I'm talking about. They will not know. But it's so wonderful. It really is. If you go out and you copy something and you're happy with what you've copied and now it looks exactly like the scene that was there, you should be a happy man, but I'm not. And it's that trying to interpret, getting away from reality and making my own reality is what's important. Can you touch it? Well, you didn't see it when you were out there because you're not making a copy. So now you're trying to make your own reality and try to be happy with your own reality is what the difficulty is.
That's great.
Thanks for having me here.
We're really glad that you were able to make the trip, and we'll look forward to being there.
Oh, thanks very much.
Thank
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Krissa Hewitt and I would like to thank today's guest, Carl Dempwolf, who has a show opening this Saturday, March 4th, at Studios on the Park in Paso Robles. More information about Carl, spelled with a K, Dempwolf, spelled D-E-M-P-W-O-L-F, can be found using a search engine. Details on the exhibit can be found at studiosonthepark.org. Next week, we talk with a fellow exhibitor, Daladier Almeida, who hails from Brazil. You have been listening to Ears on Art, a program presented the first and second Wednesday of each month at 1:30 p.m. and is produced in the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque, and along with co-host and co-producer Krissa Hewitt, we thank today's guest, Carl Dempwolf. And as always, we thank our dedicated listeners. We'll check in next week here at Ears on Art.